Hello, this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 53, and today I'm joined by Christopher Moore, lecturer in philosophy and classics and Mediterranean studies here at Penn State. Christopher received his PhD from the University of Minnesota in 2008, and his areas of specialization include ancient philosophy, Socrates, aesthetics, and democratic theory. He has a number of articles in press and forthcoming, including Chaerephon, Telephus, and Cure in Plato's Gorgias, which will be coming out in May 2012 from Arethusa, and The Myth of Tois in the Phaedrus, in Status, Users, and Function of Plato's Myths, edited by Catherine Colbert, Pierre Destrée, and Francisco Gonzalez, which will be forthcoming from Brill in the spring of 2012, and a Socratic Persuasion in the Crito, which will appear in, will be appearing this month in the British Journal of the History of Philosophy. So I am really glad to have Christopher here on the Digital Dialogue and also here at Penn State, because it means I have another person working in the area in which I'm interested. And we've been having a wonderful time doing translation of the Phaedrus over the last few weeks with grad students. And so welcome, Chris, to Penn State and to the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you're here to talk a little bit about an essay that you have written on the Phaedrus. And particularly, I think, takes a really interesting approach, which is to focus on this early quote in the Phaedrus where Socrates appeals to Pindar. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about what you're trying to do in the essay and what the essay's main sort of thesis and thrust is.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of Socrates' very first remarks in this dialogue, the Phaedrus, is a quotation from Pindar, who is an early 5th century lyric poet who wrote primarily odes in celebration of athletic victors. And the poem that Socrates is quoting is called the First Isthmian from its position in an edited volume of poems in celebration of victors at the Isthmian Games. And this is a 60-line poem commissioned probably by the family of this chariot driver named Herodotus, and probably presented aloud to the neighbors, family members, friends of Herodotus when he came back to his hometown of Thebes. Socrates quotes this poem, a certain passage of it, to express his eagerness to hear about how Phaedrus, the person he's talking to in this dialogue, spent the morning with the famous speechwriter Lysias. And so Socrates says something like, "Don't you think I would judge it as Pindar says, a thing surpassing even the lack of leisure?" And when Pindar is writing his poem, he is speaking about how he just received a commission from Herodotus' family to write a poem. And he says he was already busy doing something else, writing a poem to somebody else, but because Herodotus is from Thebes, as Pindar is himself, he says, well, this obligation is so great that even being busy on other things, it's more important for me to do this, and I'm eager to do it, and I'd like to do it right away. So I'm seeing that quotation and thinking, boy, there's a lot of reasons to look more fully into it. In the first case, it's one of the first things Socrates says, and as we've been talking about, the first page or so is highly elusive and programmatic for the remainder of the dialogue. Second, it's about leisure, and the questions surrounding the issue of leisure come up all the time in the dialogue, not least when Socrates says that I have no leisure to do anything but follow the Delphic commandment to know myself. In the dialogue, there's many instances where Socrates is either quoting poets or saying, this speech that I'm giving, it's basically, I think, from some poet, though I'm not really sure who. I'm not responsible. It's the poet who's responsible for it. And then fourth, there's a lot of things about this poem to Herodotus which are surprisingly familiar when we have read the dialogue, the Phaedrus, and And so it's these parallels that I try to focus on that allow us to say maybe there's more to this allusion to the Pindar poem than just being urbane and witty and appropriate. But that Socrates, in alluding to the poem, which probably would be well known by people of his era, since the poem would have been written just several decades prior, he's prompting them to think about the issues in the poem. And once they've thought about the issues in the poem, maybe when they then read the remainder of the dialogue, or I mean, from Plato's perspective, yeah. when the readers read the remainder of the dialogue, or from Phaedrus, his friend's perspective, when he listens to the remainder of the conversation, certain themes will be brought especially
well,
to bear. Well,
one of the things that's really nice about focusing on that moment in the dialogue is it's right at the beginning, and you have this sense of, first of all, Phaedrus is on his way from having just heard this conversation, or actually just read, had this speech read by Lysias. He was just with Lysias. He clearly, as we learn in a moment or two later in the dialogue, he has the speech with him. Mm-hmm. And he's on his way out to the out beyond the city walls into the countryside to take a walk following the orders of his doctor. One point that you just made that I liked, and you made it in the essay too, which was this notion of interruption, this being willing to be interrupted. Socrates, I think, constantly in his encounters with others is willing to have the natural course of his life or his day interrupted by the possibility of a discussion that might follow.
Right, right. And we don't know what Socrates was doing right outside the gates of Athens, but we suspect he might have been going to a gymnasium or coming from a gymnasium. Many of them were out in the suburbs outside the walls. He might just have been getting some air. Maybe he was meeting someone or had met someone. But given that he later on says, I do nothing other than seek self-knowledge, and we have experience from many others of Plato's dialogues that he is going to gymnasia to talk to people to pursue self-knowledge, that he had likely been doing the kinds of stuff he does. Mm-hmm. But Phaedrus, who sometimes people think of just as this bumbling guy who's quite enthusiastic about silly things, Socrates says, oh, no, it's more important for me right now to deal with this guy and to engage in conversation somehow with this guy who I know and I like, than for me to do whatever else I was planning to do.
Maybe we could come back to the question of what kind of a person Phaedrus is, because I'd like to make the argument that he's actually a little bit more astute than some people, commentators want to admit. But in any case, I mean, that's sort of secondary to the point that that you emphasize, but I also think that the quotation emphasizes this notion of something that's more important than business, mm-hmm. right? And it really gives a kind of it says quite a lot about Socrates' own attitude about what is most important, mm-hmm. namely the opportunity to have a conversation with somebody. And as you make the point also in the essay that Phaedrus is from Athens, Socrates is from Athens, so the parallel there between Pindar and Herodotus both being from Thebes, mm-hmm. Holds. So it's a matter of caring for and praising, mm-hmm. In Pindar's case, the people from one's hometown.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So Pindar says that he's going to praise Herodotus, but in doing so, he also talks about Herodotus' father and the trials and tribulations that his father, probably was an important Theban individual, went through and overcame. And at the end of the poem, Pindar says that people who jealously hoard their money, who don't want to have any outlay which would have public benefit, are going to be living basically a bad life. He says that there's going to be no benefit to them in the grave. And so from the first Isthmian and from lots of other Pindaric poems, we realize that Pindar is saying, I'm glorifying the athlete's virtues because they deserve being glorified, but also because those are the virtues which your city should reach for. You, Victor, are the exemplary figure in this kind of life that we all admire. You, Victor, maybe are exemplifying certain athletic traits, but the traits that go into being an Olympic champion, like resource outlay, like practice, like ignoring ephemeral desires, those are all the kinds of traits that any person in a well-running city would want to attain.
Then you want to maybe talk a little bit about the peculiarity of Herodotus as a charioteer in this that you draw out in this, namely the fact that he rides his own horse, he drives his own chariot.
Right. So the chariot race, which had either two or four horses, was the most prestigious event in these semi-annual Panhellenic games. And most of the time, the owner of the horse and the person who got, or the owner of the chariots and the person who got the praise was not actually the jockey.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the same as today, where it's the owner of Seabiscuit or whatever that gets praise and not the jockey. Many people don't even know the jockeys, and the jockeys will have to ride multiple horses per game. So Herodotus is extraordinary, at least with respect to Olympic victors that Pindar talks about, in managing and driving his own chariot. And what's remarkable about this is that it makes us have to focus on not just the skills that Herodotus must have had to train his horses, but also the skills of being a pilot of what is in fact a fairly dangerous sport, not unlike race car driving, where chariots are all the time running into one another, and especially chariots that are not well driven, because chariots that are not well driven will always be trying to seek the lead from the very beginning, and so there'll be this rustling and smashing into each other and running into the walls and so forth. It seems that from the evidence we have from Homer and from Euripides, that there was a broad view that to succeed in a chariot race, you would have to be very self-controlled and pull perhaps to an outside lane or hang back. At any rate, not try to lead from the beginning and then wait essentially to the end for an opening. And if you saw the opening and you're rested up and you're not banged up, then you should be able to attain it. So we'd say that Herodotus, lots of outlay of resources, but also great forethought and sophrosune temperance with respect to managing this 12-lap race.
So then the argument that you're making is, okay, there's this very, what we now are learning is kind of a rich reference to Pindar,
mm-hmm.
that resonates with certain elements of the Phaedrus. You make some points about sort of how we can map the poem and the Herodotus as a charioteer onto some of the themes in the Phaedrus. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, particularly with regard to the palinode and the charioteer in the palinode, who is sort of with these two horses, one who's much more obstreperous than the other, and so it does. I can see there's an important parallel there. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
Socrates is almost competing with Lysias to give speeches about love, and in his second speech about love, he says to give a really good speech about love, which would explain love's manic feeling, we're going to have to talk about the soul. And so he starts talking about the soul first by giving an argument about its immortality, but then spending most of his time saying, let me give you an image of what perhaps it's like to be a soul. And he says, a good image would be of a chariot and a charioteer and two horses. And you could imagine these chariots having wings, and the chariots with the horses are flying around the world, trying to look at what is most beautiful, what is most true, what is most good out in the heavens or the celestial sphere. So we have this picture that's somehow trying to evoke what it's like to be an ensouled individual, that is of this constant journey where you're going around in circles, you're trying to find what's best, but it's difficult because you are doing so at the same time as many other people are doing it. So you're trying to see what's best, but so are many other people, and there ends up being many instances of crashing, of broken wings, of falling down, from falling out of your cycle. And so this image where Socrates is trying to explain what love is really like and how love is connected both to deep desire and to this continuous effort and to what can sometimes seem a sort of manic frenzy. But we can imagine it in the context of a chariot race and the cycle of riders. And so Socrates is saying, well, on the one hand, we have gods. They're the most excellent riders. They never run into anybody. Why not? Well, because they always take the outside path, and they can wait, and they get refueled when necessary. But mortals, humans, we're not as good, and so we're always getting mixed up in the fray. And so what seems to happen is that Socrates says people start following certain gods, and when they're flying around in these orbits, they follow a certain god who seems most akin to them. Essentially, it seems to me like a pace keeper or something like that. And so they're able to become better chariot drivers by mimicking or by imitating or by following these immortals. And you might say some people want to follow Zeus, other people want to follow Hermes, whatever. Then when Socrates has talked about that part of the experience of being an ensouled being, he talks more specifically about the individual meeting of a chariot driver with his horse and chariot and some boy who he finds extremely attractive. And this episode seems to be sort of like the earlier episode, but with closer focus on some of the details. Because just like in the earlier episode, where what you need to learn to do is not get right in the fray, but instead follow a god who's taking a safer course, a more controlled course, when you have found yourself in the face of a great beauty or a very attractive person, you can't just go run up to them and express your manic passion for them. And like you were saying, Chris, part of this story that Socrates tells involves a very impetuous horse as one of them, and a less impetuous, more noble or regal horse. The impetuous horse seems to be personifying the aspect of us which is so sensitive and so receptive to beauty that we just want to throw ourselves at it. And we say that's not a bad thing. I mean, maybe it's neutral, but it could be dangerous because it will either destroy us or destroy the beloved. And so what we end up having to do to have some sort of successful relationship with the object of our love is to control our horses. And controlling our horses takes a long time. It takes a lot of practice. It takes a lot of self-control on the part of the charioteer, who would just as well like to give in to the rascally horse. And yet, this charioteer needs to develop pronoia, forethought, and think, look, I can train these horses, and we can get to this goal of this beloved, but we just need to wait, we need to take our time. And this moral concept of pronoia, also sometimes called prometheia, comes up in the Pindaric ode as well, where to be successful, one needs to have forethought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it occurs to me now that there's a lot of resonance also between what you're saying with regard to Prometheia and the Protagoras too,
sure.
And where Prometheus and Epimetheus become a big sort of big characters there at the end, and in Socrates' discussion with Protagoras, there is also a long discussion of poetry and how to read poetry and that sort of thing. But maybe you could just trying to get my mind around sort of how these characters might map onto each other. So is the point that, in part, that the analog would be Pindar is to Socrates as Herodotus is to Phaedrus, or how does it work exactly with regard to the chariot in the image of the palinode? Because it does seem that Socrates is clearly in the palinode trying to get Phaedrus to see himself as embodied in this kind of chariot model of the soul, right, with all three of them, right? The horse that is impetuous, and the horse that listens to reason, and the charioteer as the embodiment of nous itself, are dimensions of the soul that Socrates wants Phaedrus to be thinking about. So the way the poem maps on to the palinode, or the way the Pindar and Herodotus map on to the relationship between Socrates and Phaedrus is complex and interesting.
Yeah, one thing that I might say is that Pindar is celebrating Herodotus, and the audience is the Thebans. And it seems as though the celebration of Herodotus is in some respect for the benefit of Herodotus, but maybe the real benefit is for his community members. Mm-hmm. And so they are both the audience and the beneficiaries. They're beneficiaries because they can identify themselves or identify with Herodotus and think, oh, we first share in some of the glory, but also we are responsible for some of the glory. And also, why don't we try to reach those ideals? Because obviously one of our countrymen was able to reach that ideal. So we see this three-party system. We might then see Socrates celebrating the charioteer with Phaedrus mm-hmm. as the audience. So Phaedrus is the one who can try now to identify himself with the highest qualities of the charioteer if he esteems what the charioteer is doing. And presumably, Socrates, being sensitive to what Phaedrus likes, will tell a story of a charioteer in terms that Phaedrus can get excited about and get behind. Phaedrus is an Athenian, so we might say his qualities, the qualities that he develops, will themselves be good for Athens in this sort of secondary way. But then I know you're also thinking about what Plato is doing. Yeah. And so we might say, well, Plato has as his audience the readers. And now who is he celebrating? Who is Plato celebrating? Obviously, what he's doing is much more complex than what Pindar is doing, because mm-hmm. Pindar is just telling a 60-line ode to one person. Plato is depicting a conversation, though a conversation with the primary character being Socrates. So we might say, well, Socrates, in some respect, is the celebrity okay. for the celebrant Plato. And if that's the case, then we'd say the Athenians are to look to Socrates and how he deals with people as a kind of embodiment and actualization of an exemplary life, of a life that would be accessible to them, the other Athenians, and that they can admire.
Right. So, okay, but then you shifted just then in the last part from thinking about the three parties involved being Plato, the Socrates as the great athlete, mm-hmm. right, to and Athens being the audience, but also there's this other audience, namely us, readers, over the course of generations, right?
Yeah, yes, and I'm not distinguishing yeah. Athens from us. So we as readers are, to the extent that we're still reading it and are connected up in the right way yeah. to Plato, are Athenians. So anyway, right. we mean Athenians as the most immediate audience. Presumably Plato also thought that non-Athenians, but people who like to identify themselves with Athens, would also be readers, and so they would get a similar kind of benefit. But to the extent that one thinks, and some or plenty of contemporary commentators are interested in figuring out how to establish this, to the extent that Plato himself is trying to be politically involved by writing his
literary works, by having a school, by doing all the other sorts of things he's doing, then we could think, well, Plato, by writing this literary text, which will be presented to some part of the Athenian populace, is treating the Athenian populace as an audience of this celebration of Socrates or this kind of Socratic life.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. And so, I mean, I guess one of the issues that I'm thinking about and interested in right now myself is the practice of Socratic politics as opposed to the practice of Platonic politics. And I do think that Plato does something similar with his readers that Socrates is trying to do with his interlocutors. So I take the point that we can identify ourselves as Athenians in this kind of broad sense, but I do think that it's that Socrates, you know, he addresses anybody who's willing to engage with him, whether they be Athenians or not. And I think, as you point out, Plato's writing does that too. I mean, he's even in the Phaedrus, it says, you know, one of the things that's he has Socrates suggest that one of the issues that's problematic about writing is that it can be read by anyone and it can be taken up by anyone, and that's both and that's stigmatizing the dialogue as a kind of danger, but it also opens up possibilities that it has a longer lasting lifespan, the written text does, than the spoken one. But I want to return to the issue of ideals and the issue of, so Herodotus has an ideal for Pindar, right, this athlete with victory, who's a victor, athletic competition being the sort of main area of his success. And then, as you nicely put it in the essay, you draw out the dimensions of competition, the sort of athletic vocabulary, and the talking, and particularly in the palinode that's operating. But one of the questions that you and I've talked about before is that, you know, Socrates, what's the ideal of Socrates is not victory in an athletic sense. In fact, when he talks in the Phaedo about becoming unphilosophical, it's precisely when he feels himself sucked into the desire to win an argument rather than to get at the truth of it. And he does a similar kind of thing with Callicles, when he sort of really holds Callicles and the Gorgias accountable for, you know, his concern for victory, for Nikia, rather than for wisdom or for truth. And so I wonder what you would do with that difference. I mean, I definitely take the formal similarity and the presenting of an ideal, and I think this functions in Socratic thinking a lot. I mean, he's even appealing to the good and the just. Those are ideals toward which we should orient our lives. But what's the role of victory? I mean, one of the concerns I have here is the way in which we all often get caught up in our dialogues with one another, winning an argument, and when you think in terms of arguments, in terms of winning and losing, it quickly becomes a kind of agonistic relationship that is not, that can diminish our ability to get at the truth.
Yeah, the first thing I would say is that in large part we have an analogy between a certain public institution, that is athletic games of skill, and a private activity that's quite hard to say anything concrete about, namely working on oneself and improving oneself. As we say, oh, you know, make yourself a better person. It's hard to say what that would involve, and it might seem a very flat-footed thing to say. Mm-hmm. But if we can say, oh, what that means is being like what athletic victors do, which is they have a very specific regimen every single day, and they do it for like 6 hours, and they probably get some trainers, and they probably have practice competitions, and they have to go through all other sorts of practical exercises. That kind of talk can help make it much more clear what the route to this private, as it were, self-involved practice is. And in racing, there's a very specific outcome of doing it well, namely you win. Now, in self-work, self-care, maybe the outcome is a little bit less clear, but you could still think maybe there's going to be some outcome. Maybe the outcome will be I will actually be happy, or I will have the kind of friend or lover that I really deserve and want to have. I think that Plato, throughout the Phaedrus, is presenting these kinds of public institutions, wooing people, athletic victory. Early on when he's talking about knowing thyself, he compares knowing thyself to doing this kind of historical reconstruction that was common around his time. So by giving some practical analogs to what ends up sometimes seem like a very existential or transcendent or psychological or psychical practice, he makes it seem like doing philosophy is not some sort of joke. It's not some like, oh, just be better. But there are some practical routes. So that's the one thing. But then I think that Socrates really would be concerned about sports stars, because he will think that they will be caught up with winning, and everyone is concerned about whether their friends won or not, and not so much about how they're developing themselves toward the good or to the fine or to the beautiful or to the true. And so I don't think that Socrates would then want to say to Phaedrus, well, just do what Herodotus is doing. Because Herodotus, who knows, maybe he's full of himself. And I mean, he did commission a poem, or his mm-hmm. people did commission a poem by Pindar, which is, you know, maybe a little bit of a tacky thing to do. And so I think that there's not much risk from our side in thinking, oh, because Socrates is appealing to the structural thing, a victory ode, or he's appealing to this practical thing, training for athletic victory, that he's then saying, oh, that's the kind of thing I'm looking for. I think he can still say, obviously we're seeking out truth or beauty or goodness or justice or self-understanding or whatever. And since Socrates is not constructing his entire conversation with Phaedrus around this one poem, and it's not like the entire dialogue is on an athletic theme. Mm-hmm. You say there's just part of it. And so that part is evoking this kind of praise for virtue. The term virtue erita comes up a couple times in the poem. So we say that's sort of like the limit of its usefulness. I suppose the third thing that I would mention is that Pindar, I think to some extent, is trying not to praise Herodotus simply for winning. He says, I'm not going to tell you. I don't have any time to list what his particular victories were in. And so one might think that the central part of the ode, what did he win? Why should we celebrate him? That part is elided, and his primary focus, it seems, is on, first, what kinds of virtues went into this eventual championship, what are other people like his father doing, and what were his virtues, and then showing the mythic continuity between Herodotus and legendary champions like Heracles. And when we think of these legendary characters, we're certainly not thinking of their championships, even if they did happen to win some contest. We're mostly thinking about what their traits were, their various heroic traits of self-determination, mental fortitude, and so forth, that allowed them to prevail.
Well, one of the things that you emphasize here, which I think is critical, is this question of practice, because it does seem that, you know, that in the Phaedrus, what we see is Socrates practicing his version of the art of rhetoric, which is not the version that is practiced by the star rhetorical athletes of the time. And partly because it's partly not the same, precisely because of the question of victory, the question of a concern for creating a clever or argument that will, you know, put your opponent in an untenable position or that sort of thing, but is in fact oriented by a shared concern for the truth, and allows itself to be animated by that principle. And so, but I think what you emphasize is critical, namely the fact that this doesn't just happen, but it's practiced. In fact, we just got finished reading this in the beginning of the Phaedrus, when Phaedrus says, or when Socrates sees the written text of Lysias under the cloak of Phaedrus, and says, well, if you know, I'm not going to let you practice on me when we have the written text itself here. Right, so this idea that Phaedrus was going to go out and practice reciting this speech on Socrates and get better at it, that kind of practice is not the practice that Socrates wants to cultivate. Right? It's this other practice, namely this much more critical engagement with written text and spoken text that we see Socrates practicing in the dialogue.
Right, and I think that the contrast with this other kind of rhetoric where its victory is measured by specific instances, specific contests, I think that's good. Socrates, you might say, well, thinks, oh, I'd like to succeed in my rhetorical practice, but that will probably involve many conversations over many days, over many seasons, and having my interlocutors come to know themselves better, come to appreciate justice and the value of philosophical conversation, the value of love. So his practice can still be oriented towards some sort of success, but maybe it's much more attenuated or long-term, whereas individual rhetoricians that are admired by Phaedrus would be seeking this very momentary success. Can I persuade this audience, this jury, this assembly, to vote for my preferred person right now? I don't care what they believe tomorrow. They'll probably believe something else, but as long as I can hold their conviction for a couple hours, I'm happy. And in part, this kind of contrast I think is so important because I think that many times Socrates gets quite a bad rap when people say, look at all these dialogues where he doesn't succeed. He has failed to persuade his interlocutor.
But I mean, interestingly, the Phaedrus is an example of a dialogue where he does succeed because he has, that by the end, convinced Phaedrus to go back to Athens and convince Lysias to write differently, to write with an eye toward the good and the just. And so it seems that this is a good example of success. This dialogue is a good example, and one of many, a number. And I would argue that Socrates is more successful if we look at success as in a different way. And so he's successful in this dialogue precisely because of the way he practices dialogue with Phaedrus.
Right. And so that would be consistent, too, with saying, well, in some dialogues, maybe the interlocutor does not say, oh, you're right, Socrates, or walks away or something like that. And yet it would seem perhaps the wrong model of rhetoric to think Socrates can succeed only if by the end of this totally arbitrarily length dialogue that the part of the conversation Plato chooses to depict, you know, his interlocutor says, oh, yes, of course, you're right. I mean, that just doesn't seem to ring true with what we often know about trying to convince people to see another way of life. It takes much, much time. And if we think of the Pindaric poem as speaking at these great temporal removes, probably a younger, middle-aged man, Herodotus, his father, these legendary heroes, we can think about how long it can take to develop the kind of skill or excellence that we esteem. And there's no problem with that. In fact, we esteem it even more if we think, oh, it took a long time to get here. Mm-hmm. Oh, we had to go, you know, with Herodotus' father, he had to undergo some downturn before he got his act together. And we say, yeah, that's admirable.
So let me ask this final thing, because I know we're running out of time, but What do you make of the suggestion that we, you and I had in a conversation prior to this, the suggestion that you could see the Phaedrus itself as having the structure of a chariot race, with a sort of going out to this point and making a turn and coming and returning back to Athens, is sort of just in the same way that as a chariot race goes out and around the turn and back and repeatedly does that. But I mean, it would, if you gave the structure of the dialogue that chariot course structure, then you do have yet another way of reinforcing this idea that what they're doing is in sort of practicing a certain way of life, but also, which is also a way of going, a way of a path, a course. Let's put it that way.
I've been thinking about that, and I'm not sure. The chariot race has some number of cycles, probably 12, and at least in the Phaedrus as we see it, there's just one. Though there may be some sort of promissory note that there will be further conversations. The other thing is that Pindar's poem is not structured as a chariot race, and so because that's the case, I think at least the more important thing to be focused on, at least in my reading, is that Socrates is praising something. He's praising the life of Eros and the philosophical life. And this is in contrast to other things we could take the dialogue to be doing, namely giving some analysis that we are to accept objectively or impersonally, rather, an analysis of love or mania or true rhetoric. And we might say, sure, those things are in there, but they seem to be contributing to the praise of this kind of life, and much interpretation will have to go into. How do the parts of the conversation Socrates had with Phaedrus contribute to this praise of a life dedicated to Eros and philosophical discussion? Now, I think that it is clear that Plato is conscientiously dramatizing the walking around in some sort of circle. And at the beginning of the dialogue, Socrates talks about this one doctor's advice to run up to a wall and back as exercise. And in fact, some later ancient speculation about this doctor's advice is that you were to run up to the wall and back multiple times. So you would be doing some sort of cyclical exercise. And so I think that the idea of the race as some activity where you bear in mind a goal, and what you do in the middle part is trying to not get ahead of yourself in some respect, trying not to just win whatever intermediary victories you can get, but keep yourself prepared for the end. I think if we look at the dialogue in that respect, I think that makes quite consistent the two ideas that we both have, where Socrates has to do all this stuff in order to persuade Phaedrus in the end to care about philosophical discussion and not to, as it were, burn himself out at the beginning by giving some eloquent recitation of Lysias's clever poem.
Right. Well, it certainly seems that Socrates is I mean, for Socrates, the race is a human life, right? And takes up the whole course of a human life. So, and he's always focused on that larger idea and is trying, it seems, to convince Phaedrus to do the same. And seems to have done so fairly successfully in this dialogue, given that Phaedrus does come back to willing to convince Lysias that he should think a little bit differently about the way he writes. But, well, this has been a great conversation, Christopher, and I am really glad, as I said at the beginning, to have you here at Penn State so that we can have more of these kinds of conversations. And thank you for coming on the Digital Dialogue.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity.
This has been the Digital Dialogue. Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. If you'd like to learn more about the Digital Dialogue, I invite you to visit my website at www.la.psu.edu/chrislong. And on the Digital Dialogue Facebook page at www.facebook.com/digitaldialogue. You can also find the Digital Dialogue now on Google+. Thank you for listening to the Digital Dialogue.